Funding for Think comes from the SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
An estimated 100 million people tuned into last night's presidential debate. Some viewers hoped to see their favorite take the other candidate down. Others were just curious to see the spectacle. But surely there were some who watched the debate hoping to gain some insight into Donald J. Trump and Hillary Rodham Clinton to understand who they really are. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. The debate may have been a start. Another must-see program tonight might add more dimension to what you know. The Frontline documentary, The Choice 2016, is a two-hour side-by-side biography of the woman and the man who are our choices for president this year. And the revelations it contains may surprise you. Filmmaker Michael Kirk directed The Choice 2016. It airs tonight on PBS stations around the country, including KERA-TV in North Texas. Michael, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris. Nice to be here.
The film opens with what may have been the inspiration for Donald Trump's entry into politics, the White House Correspondents' Dinner of 2011. President Obama took a couple of pot shots at Trump, who was in the audience. What made that such a seminal moment?
Well, all politicians, even brand new ones like Donald Trump, are extremely vulnerable to humiliation. Usually at an event like the Washington Correspondents' Dinner, there's a kind of a roast of prominent reporters and prominent public figures in the audience, the president getting a chance to get his jabs in. He went a step further against Donald Trump, who had been basically taking Obama on for a long time about the birther issue. So this was, in a way, Obama's 3 days after Obama had released the long form birth certificate, he decided to make a pinata out of Donald Trump and literally, unremittingly, ceaselessly attempted to humiliate him. And by the accounts of those who were in the room, who are kind of used to people being roasted and handling it, especially those closest to Donald Trump, this was a moment he never forgot and may never get over.
The birther thing always seemed like a strange issue to get hung up on, since in any case, the president's mother was by every account a U.S. citizen. Why did Donald Trump make that an issue?
Well, in our film, we demonstrate something about Donald. We start with both of the candidates as they were little children and move our way forward. You begin along the road to learn an awful lot about who they are, their sort of makeup, and in some ways be able to predict what they'll do. In the case of Trump, by 1988, his businesses were starting to fail. He'd had great success building the Trump Tower, but he was in a little bit just starting to tip over the edge. He'd been on a binge of buying things. And he writes a book or has a book written called The Art of the Deal, and he's trying to sell the book. And one of the things one of his political advisors, Roger Stone, suggests is that they, gin up some publicity, go to Portsmouth, New Hampshire in the Trump helicopter and put on a kind of supposed presidential race, a testing of the waters. And up there, Trump starts to talk about many of the issues that even live with him today. So what happens to him is he gets the bug. He then starts to enter into, he buys a couple of full-page ads in the New York Times, one about international relations and one about the Central Park jogger rape case that happens there. And he's suddenly very interested in public issues. And he said to one of the people we talked to, it was an amazing to him that how easy it was to get free publicity. He'd become quite astute at creating celebrity for himself. And along the way, he learned how to grab an issue and listen carefully to see whether it caught on. And if it did, he would then exploit the issue. That's what he does when he sells hamburgers or buildings or whatever he was doing. So when it came time for the birther, or when it came time for him to really get sort of serious, he was thinking about running instead of Romney in 2011 or against Romney. he picks up the birther issue, which is kind of laying around out there. And I ask Stone in the film tonight, what was he doing? Where did that come from? And he said, really good question. I think he got it off the internet. And I really do think it was as simple as that. He was trolling around looking for something. Trolling means a different thing now, but he was looking around on the internet and came across birther and thought, well, this is a good one. And he tried it out in a couple of events, and it really caught on with what people around Trump say was what he called the Archie Bunkers. And that was that. He had an issue, and they couldn't get him off of it, and he loved it and by all accounts understood it for what it was, which was a way to get Donald Trump as a politician in the news.
So if Trump has been thinking about a career in politics for just a few years, by contrast, Hillary Clinton has been laying the groundwork, as you say in the film, for decades. She struggled mightily in the beginning to function as a traditional political wife, particularly in a state like Arkansas. Can you talk about how she was received during her husband's first term as governor?
Yes, happily, Chris. But let me just back up just a little tiny bit and tell you that a big surprise to me was that by 1969 and 1970, in the midst of, you know, the turmoil of the late 60s and the sort of political activism, Hillary had become someone very highly respected in that very first days of the feminist women's movement in the United States. She had gone to Wellesley, an all-women's college in the Boston area, had become the commencement speaker, the first student there who'd ever given a commencement speech. She took great exception to the speech that had gone before her by the first black United States senator since Reconstruction, Senator Brooke, who had sort of looked down his nose on the liberal kids. Hillary jumps up, argues with him in her speech, gets in Life magazine and becomes a superstar almost overnight. Somebody dubbed her the voice of a generation, so that by the time she graduates from Yale Law School, works at the Watergate Commission, is on her way to superstardom as a young 22, 23-year-old woman, she suddenly, surprisingly, it knocks everybody's socks off, decides to leave it all and go to Arkansas to be with her college boyfriend, her law school boyfriend, Bill, of all people, Clinton. And everybody we talk to, who is her friend, her landlady, everybody, is just thunderstruck that this amazing young woman would go to Arkansas and hang out with Bill Clinton. So that by the time Clinton wins the governorship, he's in his, I think he's 32, and at the time is the youngest governor in America, and so is she, as the first lady, you realize that there is this woman who's living in Arkansas, who's really a sort of East Coast liberal effete, but is the wife of the governor. She's a wife who will not take his name. She doesn't have a child. As they say in Arkansas, she works out of the home, which is, she's a corporate lawyer. And she really does take a beating for this down in Arkansas. And a lot of people who know her well and would go visit her would come back just scratching their heads like, what is she doing here?
Do you think that Bill Clinton's attraction to her had to do with the fact that her star initially was higher than his?
She was a much bigger deal than he was. He was legendary. Of the story I heard that best sums up who Bill Clinton was he was from Arkansas. It was kind of easy for an Arkansas kid with pretty good grades to get a Rhodes Scholarship. So, and he had gone to Georgetown. So he went off on a Rhodes Scholarship, 40 guys on the boat. All of them, I was talking to one of the guys on the boat, Robert Reich, and he said that every guy on the boat believed that someday they would be a United States senator or president of the United States when they left New York. By the time they got to London, they all knew that only one of them was going to be president of the United States, and that was Bill Clinton. He just had that political stardust that a lot of people, when they met him even then, knew that he had. But by the time he gets to Yale, she is a bigger star. She is the one that dazzles him, and it's not the other way around. Now, if you talk to her close friends, she, of course, was attracted to him in a kind of physical way, but she was also saw in him that thing that those Rhodes Scholar fellows on the boat saw, and that is that this guy had real possibility no matter where he was from. And she decided, she made that calculation to attach herself to him and form a political partnership that, of course, at some moment would also be a romance.
I want to play a little sound here from last night's debate of Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump talking about their economic plans.
We need to have strong growth, fair growth, sustained growth. We also have to look at how we help families balance the responsibilities at home and the responsibilities at business. So we have a very robust set of plans, and people who have looked at both of our plans have concluded that mine would create 10 million jobs and yours would lose us 3.5 million jobs and explode
the debt. You are going to approve one of the biggest tax cuts in history. You are going to approve one of the biggest tax increases in history. You are going to drive business out. Your regulations are a disaster, and you're going to increase regulations all over the place. And by the way, my tax cut is the biggest since Ronald Reagan. I'm very proud of it. It will create tremendous numbers of new jobs. But regulations, you are going to regulate these businesses out of existence.
Secretary Clinton, Michael, is quick to characterize her family as middle class, and maybe it would be more accurate to say upper middle class, but she says middle class. Donald Trump never was middle class, doesn't see a lack of wealth as anything to be proud of. The film notes that his father, Donald Trump's father, Fred, made all his children work as kids, but maybe not the way you and I might have worked as kids to raise some extra money. Will you tell us about Trump's first job?
Well, Trump, when he was they lived in luxury, but they lived in Queens, which for those of you in Texas, you may not understand the implications of that. But if you live in Manhattan, you're rich. If you live in Brooklyn, you're a millennial or a yuppie or you're on the edges of money and maybe fame. If you live in Queens, you're working class and in some ways even worse than that. And he lived in a mansion in the middle of Queens, which is a kind of weird thing to be. His father made them work, and Donald had a paper route. But when it rained, the chauffeur drove him around. And even sometimes the chauffeur who was driving him around was his dad. It was just, you know, not exactly a deprivation. Although when you grow up in a mansion in Jamaica States in Queens, you do have a little bit of a thing about elites, because you really are looked down upon by the people who live in Manhattan in you know, the Emerald City.
Is it fair to say that both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton had hard-to-please fathers in different ways?
I think it's an understatement. I thought it was amazing last night when she was talking about her dad running the drapery company. They lived in a suburb called Park Ridge, which was on the outskirts of Chicago, all white, you know, built basically after World War II. From Park Ridge, they could watch the building of Chicago's O'Hare Airport as it was, you know, growing over all the acres out there. Her father was very demanding, especially of Hillary, the oldest child. She has two brothers. If Hillary got an A, he said, well, that must be an awful easy school you go to, one of those kind of dads. He was even harsher on Hillary's mom, Dorothy. And really, lots and lots of people we talked to said abusive. Not physically abusive, but definitely verbally abusive, diminishing. And the arguments were phenomenal. Dorothy, for her part, sort of took it, but Hillary would run upstairs and cover her ears, and it's one of the reasons lots of kids didn't go over to her house to hang out, because Hillary was anxious about what would happen between her parents, and a lot of people we talked to said that was the beginning of the penchant for privacy and secrecy that we see so deeply ingrained in her now.
We're speaking this hour with filmmaker Michael Kirk, who directed the Frontline documentary The Choice 2016. It airs tonight on KERA television. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. We'll be right back.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, where students can customize their degree, like Diane Jay, internationally published creative writer. More at smu.edu/DLS.
There was a lot of fighting in the Rodham household, and I don't think she invited many friends home. That's when her whole penchant for secrecy and privacy began.
There is an old money elite in Manhattan that has never accepted Donald. He was considered, I think, loud and obnoxious and too self-centered and ill-mannered and not someone who fit in. And so I think this is where Donald's resentment of the elite comes from.
That was Gail Sheehy and Michael D'Antonio from the Frontline documentary, The Choice 2016. We have its director, Michael Kirk, with us today. The Frontline documentary, The Choice 2016, airs tonight on KERA television, a really interesting piece of work to consider after having seen the debates last night. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Michael, was there anything last night that surprised you based on how well you have come to know these individuals through the work you've done on the documentary?
Well, yes and no. So the yes is I was surprised that Donald. So think of it this way. I mean, it's an obvious metaphor. Think of it as a boxing match, okay, like a serious heavyweight championship fight where everybody's tuning in. And Hillary is the jabber, the stay-in-close, the protector of information, the not letting herself go out too far, not drilling down too deeply, but just trying to poke at him a little bit and get him mad. He's the guy who doesn't have any kind of a plan, but he's got a serious haymaker, like a right hand that he can just knock you out with. And he's looking for a way to use it, and she's, you know, jabbing him what Muhammad Ali used to call stinging like a bee. She's trying to get inside and eventually does for a while in there. And it's one of those, for me, unsatisfactory nights where there's a lot of noise and not a lot of real revelation about who they are. I mean, especially when you know them as well as I think I do, and you see references to things like fathers and secrets and race and his business and her role as Secretary of State, and you want to sort of stand up and say, but wait, here's the truth, everybody. They're going to have to watch it tonight. But for me, it was watching it was frustrating because I could see her, the Hillary we know, the Hillary who's closed and careful and a policy grind and somebody who hasn't kind of let herself be whoever those people are who love her. She has friends from kindergarten who are still her best friends and see her all the time and talk to me about her as if she was this unbelievably warm and generous and open person. But you don't see much of that. All this lifetime on the stage all feels so audience tested and practiced. And I shouldn't say anything right now. Just let him go. You know, you could see her trying to control herself. These are mistakes she's made all of her public life. She doesn't really let whatever that other Hillary is, if there is another Hillary by now, out in the open. And Trump is a beginner. And, you know, it may be that to the people who like him, a lot of people in Texas apparently really, really like him, it may be that they like the idea that this is a guy who's just swinging for the fences every time, sort of without any plan and obviously without any policy. One of the things we discover in the telling of their life stories is how much Donald is a sort of freelancer, but a very, very good one. He has a sense for what the audience wants, what the viewers need, what the voters are. He was the really first big politician who discovered that voters and viewers, and he did this on The Apprentice, the TV show, that viewers and voters are the same thing now People think of entertainment and news as essentially the same thing. And he, Donald Trump, is looking for whatever it is out there that he can tap into, just like when he tries to sell things. That's what he does. He's really, really good at it. He's not good at business and hasn't been for a long time and isn't really good as an entrepreneur. He's now a human logo, but a really good one at it. And as the human logo, he's trying to sell himself as president. And you see him doing it. But without any standards, without really, you know, without really any rigor, and that the two could be so different on that stage is in itself a remarkable phenomenon, but not necessarily a good one to get at which one of those people should be president of the United States.
Well, let's listen to, you know, you refer to the noise that we heard last night, and I think this exchange, it's a couple minutes here, but it's a good example of, I think, what you're telling us.
I've been under audit almost for 15 years. I know a lot of wealthy people that have never been audited. I said, do you get audited? I get audited almost every year. And in a way, I should be complaining. I'm not even complaining. I don't mind it. It's almost become a way of life. I get audited by the IRS, but other people don't. I will say this. We have a situation in this country that has to be taken care of. I will release my tax returns against my lawyer's wishes. When she releases her 33,000 emails that have been deleted, as soon as she releases them, I will release my tax returns. And that's against my lawyers. They say, don't do it.
So you've got to ask yourself, why won't he release his tax returns? And I think there may be a couple of reasons. First, maybe he's not as rich as he says he is. Second, maybe he's not as charitable as he claims to be. Third, we don't know all of his business dealings, but we have been told through investigative reporting that he owes about $650 million to Wall Street and foreign banks. Or maybe he doesn't want the American people, all of you watching tonight, to know that he's paid nothing in federal taxes, because the only years that anybody's ever seen were a couple of years when he had to turn them over to state authorities when he was trying to get a casino license, and they showed he didn't pay any federal income tax. So
that makes
if
me
he's
smart.
Paid zero, that means zero for troops, zero for vets, zero for schools or health. And I think probably he's not all that enthusiastic about having the rest of our country see what the real reasons are, because it must be something really important, even terrible, that he's trying to hide.
That's such an interesting exchange, Michael Kirk, because Hillary Clinton is clearly trying to get under Donald Trump's skin. He all but admitted that he didn't pay much income tax, which is fascinating in that that response effectively is like confirmation of the fact that if we do ever see his returns and it turns out he hasn't paid much tax, he's pretty sure that won't matter to people.
As the people really close to him, especially Roger Stone, told us, this is a guy who walks the high wire without a net whenever he's giving a speech or a presentation. He's sort of used to, by the way, talking to people in the crowd who love him. It was the remarkable thing last night. I watched it at a place called the Newseum in Washington. Yeah. I'd been giving a presentation, and then we all sat, 300 or 400 or 500 of us, however many the big theater fits, and I'm watching 60-foot on the screen Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton side by side. And in our audience, people were reacting to things he said and she said. But there at Hofstra, it was not that. And I thought Donald was not nearly as kind of connected as he often is, because he really feeds off of the energy of the true believers. I mean, who wouldn't? But he especially needs the kind of guidance of their vibration. If you're a man who's walking the high wire without a net, you want to know, what are they buying? What are they liking? What do they need of all the things I have to say? That's why, by the way, I think a lot of things that he often talks about, he didn't really talk about. Where was the wall? Where were other things? And why he almost got distracted at times instead of pursuing her on her apology for the emails. I mean, there was a lot more he could have hammered her with, and he didn't, partly, I think, because the format itself, with nobody in the crowd who he could see and feed off of, I think it was hard for him in that sense, and I think that's who he's always been. And in Hillary's case, she had really practiced all of that. She, every nuance, every move, every smile, every grimace, every part of her, I promise you, had been worked on over and over and over again, and all the phraseology and the way that she goes after him. Yes, she's prodding him, but you know what she's doing. It's a calculation with her, and he's the opposite of calculation. He is pure, raw, here I go, let me go. It's like, releasing a bull with a rider on it. This thing is going to go for it, and that's without being demeaning to him. I mean, that is his style. That is what he wants to do. That's who he thinks people want him to be. And that's who he certainly was last night about those issues. The things like the tax return, and when you see the film tonight, you'll understand why he goes so far in all of these things, because he really does believe, A, there's no such thing as bad publicity. People forget the bad things that you may have said, so you can go too far. He believes in a thing called truthful hyperbole. And what that really means is he can sort of lie and say it over and over and over again, and he freely admits it, that he'll do it just to get attention, just to get people's attention, and that if he says it enough, people will begin to believe it. So you saw good evidence of that from Donald last night, and you saw very strong evidence from Hillary of the programmability of who she is. It's why they're each of them have such high undesirables. People, for various reasons, don't buy the public Hillary, and the private Hillary is kind of locked up. And I think people might want to know, but I think that may be where the fear of her lying and other things comes from. And the other parts of Donald that people don't like, certain people don't like, is that they just fear him. They just think, how can we have a president who just shoots from the lip like this?
Has this election changed your sense as a journalist of the power that the media have to speak truth to power, to sort of inform the American public of what's true and what's not true?
I think it's from where I sit. I've been doing this a long time. I'm a very lucky person. I get to make 3 hours a year of long-form, in-depth, the biggest topics there are, kind of documentary films that millions of people see and get, shown all around the world. So in some ways, I don't have to be a competitive journalist in that sense. I get to take a big, long view of things and step back, and I've been doing it a long, long time. But so I want to say that there's a lot of things I'm very critical about journalism, but I want people to understand that, I don't know how I'd be if I had to do it, but thank God I don't have to do it, because the press has not done, in the main, a very good job of this. They didn't, they ignored Donald Trump at the very beginning, and then they didn't bring rigor to him when it became apparent that he was representing something in America. They didn't see it that way. They dismissed him. They didn't go out and talk to Americans, much the way the other Republican candidates, Jeb Bush and others, didn't respond. But the press has an obligation, it seems to me, to get out there and find those things out and bring them back in a kind of coherent and intelligent way. What is Donald Trump doing? Who is he reaching? How is that happening? Gee, that's fascinating that this guy, could do it. And in Hillary's case, she has been getting, basically hammered for 34 years for all kinds of things, some of which she really deserves. But again, where's the rigor from journalism coming at it and saying, we're really going to take a hard look at this. I mean, I've spent and been lucky enough to spend months and months finding out who they really are and what they really have become and what's the likelihood of who they are once we reveal it. How will they lead? So I spend all my life thinking about their life method and how they became what they became. you don't have to go as deep as I went if you're a journalist, but I think you do have an obligation not to chase it and shamelessly encourage the Trump boomlet back when it was a boomlet just for ratings. You think Fox and MSNBC and CNN didn't enjoy having Donald Trump on there all the time? And then all of a sudden journalism is talking about false equivalency and all kinds of other issues about what to do about Trump. Well, I don't think it's a problem. You report. You report on her, and you do it as fairly as you can. This shouldn't be as hard as it's been made to be, and there's nothing worse than a bunch of journalists sitting around saying, "Gee, what should we have done? We did it wrong," and all of that. It's awfully self-indulgent, if you ask me. We should have known how to do it right. But some of it is the way our business works and the profit motive, and that it's all quick and fast and dirty, and there's an awful lot of people who do it now who just don't have the experience that's necessary.
All right, let's go to the phones now. We have Diane on the line in Highland Village. Hi, Diane.
Yes, hi. Yes, what's always bothered me about Hillary Clinton is that I feel like she could achieve what she has without having married Bill, which I think has been a real big liability. And so I'd like to ask Mr. Kirk what he thinks about that assertion.
I guess we'll never know, but certainly there's a lot of people we talked to who thought she could have absolutely gone that way and been, you know, a superstar all by herself. She was that for a while. But you have to remember that when she was in the sixth grade, so Hillary Clinton, when she was in the sixth grade, which is what, the mid-50s probably, she her class prophecy was that Hillary Clinton will marry a United States senator. What that means is that the smartest girl in the class, who was the most capable at that time in America, was viewed as somebody who the best she could hope for is to marry a senator. So she made a calculation at a time before feminism and the world is the way the world is now, to hook up with a guy, hitch her star to a guy who was going to get there, and she was pretty sure she could help him get there. And now, all these years later, she may look back and regret it, but I'm not sure the times and the culture would have accepted a woman as powerful as Hillary back in the day. She had to stay with it as long as she did, and that was the choice she made.
Michael Kirk is my guest. He directed the Frontline documentary, The Choice 2016. It's a tandem biography of Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump and airs tonight on KERA-TV. We'll come back to the conversation in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program, presenting a complimentary lecture series on the American presidential election in 2016 this fall with SMU political scientist and distinguished professor Dennis Simon. You can RSVP at mls@smu.edu.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with filmmaker Michael Kirk, who directed the new Frontline documentary, The Choice 2016. It airs tonight on PBS stations across the country, including KERA Channel 13 in North Texas. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Michael, last night Hillary Clinton raised the issue of Donald Trump having been sued by the federal government over allegations that his company deliberately avoided renting apartments to African-American tenants. This comes up in your film as well. He made the point last night that he settled without an admission of guilt, said that a number of times. As it turns out, this is something I learned from your film. The case was defended by an attorney named Roy Cohn, who seems to have had a really big influence on Trump's pugilistic style in business and in politics. Who was Roy Cohn?
Well, Roy Cohn, to people in your audience who are 70 and older, is a very well-known name. He was the attorney, sidekick, pal, partner of Joseph McCarthy, the Wisconsin senator who ran what later became described as a witch hunt by the United States Senate against supposed communists in America, including a lot of writers in Hollywood, and there's been movies made about it. And Roy was this very intense and enigmatic, and there's a lot about him that just doesn't make sense, contrast. He was a huge, when he had finally gotten sort of abused and diminished by what happened in Washington with McCarthy, he moved to New York, where he was a superpower broker on the kind of underbelly of political deals and how to get something through City Hall or how to win a lawsuit or how to use a lawsuit to bludgeon somebody. He was just an amazing guy. He was a homosexual who was incredibly anti-gay. When the scourge of AIDS just basically ripped through New York, he was on one side and then he was on another side about it. He was just intense. And he was Donald Trump's mentor about how to handle business deals, legal matters, social life, all kinds of things in Manhattan when Trump first hit there in the 1970s. And it was Roy's idea always to go for somebody angers you, somebody does something against you, sue them for a lot of money. There are more lawsuits from Donald Trump than almost anybody else in Manhattan. It's just it's what he does. He sues people, and that is a Roy Cohn a planned attack. He also taught Trump how to handle the tabloids, how to build his celebrity, how to get his name out there. There's no such thing as bad publicity, et cetera, as he went through these incredibly public and hideous divorces. This Trump, it was Roy there all the time, you know, with the next prenup and the next this and the next that. And when this discrimination from the federal government, discrimination action takes place, they basically have the Trump team, Donald and his father, dead to rights. They've got Trump people who are like showing people houses. If the person is an African American, they write C next to their name, and of course the person doesn't get the house, or the number 9 next to their name, and the person doesn't get the house. So Trump has been had dead to rights by the federal government. But Cohn's philosophy is, no, you got to go back. You got to fight back. So they countersue the United States government for $100 million, claiming reverse racism. They fight it as long as they can. They try to muddy up the waters and make it look like they were the aggrieved party. Once that doesn't seem to be working and a judge is headed for them and they're headed for big trouble, they settle. But in the settling of it and in the way they talk about it and even in the way Don talked about it last night, all these years later, it's amazing. If you were just somebody watching it, you would say Trump won. They didn't admit any guilt. There was no problem. They didn't do anything. Well, of course, they did do something. They settled the case, and they dropped their lawsuit. But he told everybody, even though it wasn't true, that it was a success. And he said it then, and he says it now, which is just, you know, very classic Roy Cohn, Donald Trump methodology in that case. And, of course, it reveals what it reveals about both how Trump did business in terms of, and the Trump family did business in terms of renting to people and discriminating apparently against people at the time, but also the way that they handle the charges and the public or the publicity of it. He just blew right by it and came back boom, boom, boom the other direction saying, you know, we didn't admit guilt. We didn't do anything. We didn't do it. We didn't do it, despite the fact that obviously they did it.
Roy Cohn would go on to construct Trump's first prenuptial agreement before his marriage to the woman who became Ivana Trump. On the other hand, the film does not go so far as to out and out state that Hillary Clinton knew about her husband's infidelities from the beginning. But there is this assertion that she felt like she wanted to have maximum effect on public policy and realized she needed to stay married to her husband.
Yes, this is the ends and means argument made by people in the film. That is that Hillary, having made this decision to go to Arkansas, having made this decision to hook up with Bill, having made this decision to fight for her causes, having this end, which is her political ideals, to keep them intact and to keep them moving forward, and believing like many boomers did at the time, liberal boomers did at the time, that they could change America, and America needed to be changed. She was part of a giant change movement among young political figures, Gary Hart and, you know, even George McGovern. They were all trying very hard to change the government in America. And she thought she was doing it from Arkansas, preparing, of course, to run for the presidency. Well, the biggest problem they had was that Bill had a problem. He was a philanderer. And did she know the extent of the philandering? Well, there's a great deal of back and forth about this by people who were their friends, who knew that Bill, Bill was not, that Bill fooled around. And people talk about it, and when you're in Arkansas, they talk about it as what they called ungenerously bimbo eruptions, and that they were always afraid, the Clintons, that these allegations would come forward, and his political enemies were always threatening to bring them forward and occasionally would back when he was governor. So, and even these things predate that. When he ran for president, they were very worried, of course, about what would happen. And when Jennifer Flowers came forward, Hillary had to make a calculation. What does she do? Does she believe in the bigger end that they are all about? They were in the middle of the New Hampshire primary at the time. Or does she, does she talk about something she'd never talked about out loud before, which is, you know, her husband's relationship with other women? She, they decide to go on 60 Minutes. They talk about it in the vaguest possible terms. She acknowledges that there's trouble in their relationship. They don't say specifically what it was, and Bill lies about Jennifer Flowers having a 12-year relationship with Jennifer Flowers and having a relationship with Jennifer Flowers, which later, when he's deposed, everybody knows the truth about. The question for everybody inside that circle, and by the way, this is what Donald Trump was threatening to talk about, the question he was threatening to ask her last night and didn't after she dropped her bomb, which was the things about Miss Piggy, the Miss Universe contestant.
Alicia Machado, yeah.
Yes. Trump wanted to talk about it. Hillary was probably prepared to answer it. Remember, Trump had threatened to bring Jennifer Flowers to sit in the front row near Bill and Chelsea. It was getting at that level. So the question for us as we made our film, and I think the question for viewers and voters is, do you address this time in Hillary's life and her role in it, in standing by her man, in protecting him, in not being forthright about it, and not actually going to the details of it, but protecting him, and blaming a lot of it on what she called the vast right-wing conspiracy. This, for people who watch tonight, it is a window into the way Hillary and Bill, when he was elected, and Monica Lewinsky happened, Jennifer Flowers happens at the front end, Monica Lewinsky and the impeachment happened near the back of the process, and things happen along the way that are just as forcefully anti-Hillary, challenging to Hillary. It seems to me to be that moment where the scars of being Hillary Clinton get all over her. And from then on, she's in a kind of defensive crouch that we see going all the way up into the email secrecy efforts and many other things that people attach to her character as a major politician.
Let me ask you this, Michael. Lots of people are concerned that they don't feel that they can trust Hillary Clinton. Some people do trust her. Do you have the sense, she's secretive in a lot of ways. Is Hillary Clinton someone who has a hard time trusting other people?
I don't know. It's a very good question, Chris. I don't even really want to speculate on it because it's not, It's not somewhere we went. I mean, things happened to her that are sort of surprising to her, I think. She was very surprised, for example, that Barack Obama offered her the Secretary of State job. I think she trusted that by saying yes, it was going to be a chance for her to run again when he was done, and a chance for her to build a legacy, and a chance for her to do some good things for America. I mean, I think she really thought all those things were true. But very quickly, after she said yes and went to work at the State Department, she discovered that Barack Obama did not intend to give her any real authority, that he was going to run foreign policy from the White House, and that all things, little and large, over at the State Department had to be run through the Oval Office before they actually happened. This, I think, was a shock and a surprise and a very hurtful thing to her. It took her years to try to get actual access to him about any kind of a policy thing, and then that was Libya, and we all know how that ended. Hillary and trust, on the other hand, she has great close friends that love her and always hang out with her, and Donald Trump doesn't actually have any friends really at all who are those kind of friends. So, when you get down to really thinking about character and whether things like friends and trust and stuff really matter, you're really in territory that is that even as close as we got, we could never really get all the way into that. And I don't really know whether she trusts other people. I don't really know that. But there's plenty of things that have happened, including things that have happened with her husband, that you could say, and I think they were things that genuinely surprised her. Monica Lewinsky just blew her away, and she was angry for years. I think you could imagine that she has some trust issues, and going back to her father and even her mother, who had such a terrible childhood and didn't really tell Hillary for a long time. So it's a good question, and I've ruminated on it probably long enough.
Did you discover anything about Donald Trump in your investigation, who does not have a record as, you know, someone who has held public office? So in some ways, the kinds of things that you're investigating are going to be a little bit different. Did you discover things about him that pleasantly surprised you?
One thing is that we talked to very powerful and effective women who worked at high levels, high capacities for him. Executive Vice President Barbara Rez, who was really in charge of all of the construction trades on the building of Trump Tower. She handled all the subs, all the crafts workers, all the union guys, all of it in a very male world. It was just astonishing to people in the business of building in New York City that Donald Trump picked a woman to do that. He called her Donna Trump and said, "You go get him." And he gave her a lot of authority. And to this day, Barbara, who has her own problems with him eventually about some things, thanks him profusely for what he did for her and the way that he gave her authority. And she believes that he really trusted her. And the same is true with a woman named Louise Sunshine, who was also an executive vice president, I think her title was, with him and very close to Donald, still very close. They've had falling outs here and there. They even sued each other once. But I think it was a surprise to everybody to learn, on my team, to learn the extent to which Donald handled those kind of women that way, especially in light of the way he handles other kind of women in other ways.
Filmmaker Michael Kirk directed the Frontline documentary, The Choice 2016. You can see it tonight on PBS stations around the country, including KERA Channel 13 Television in North Texas. Michael, it's been a real pleasure to speak with you. Thanks for making time for us.
You bet, Chris. My pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Alan Roberts. Samantha Guzman is associate producer with help on the phones today from Javier Girabet. And our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Support for KERA comes from you, our members, and from the UNT Fine Arts Series and Distinguished Lecture Series presenting Brandon Stanton, founder of Humans of New York, September 28th at 7 p.m. at the UNT Coliseum. Tickets at untuniontickets.com.
Allied Stone, importer and fabricator of natural stone for the home. Featuring a wide selection of marble, granite, quartz, and more. You can start your project at alliedstonedfw.com.
This is your source for NPR News, 90.1 KERA, Dallas-Fort Worth, Denton, also 100.1 K261 CW in Tyler, 88.3 K202 DR in Wichita Falls, and 99.3 K257 EV in Sherman. Think is next. It's 1 o'clock.
Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, the social rules that govern talking to strangers and what we give and receive in those conversations. We'll spend the hour with Keo Stark, who believes there are opportunities for real emotional connections scattered throughout our days in even the briefest of interactions. We'll talk about what it takes to open ourselves up to moments with people we don't know and why we are sometimes clearer about communicating our emotions to strangers than to those we know very well. Our conversation starts after the news.